Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. And a happy new year, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. We're kicking off 2022 playing four Encore for the People segments previously recorded, starting with a reminder about two clinical trials going on at the Anxiety and Mood Disorders Program at the Yale Child Study Center. If you have or know of a child or teen suffering from anxiety, participation in one of these trials may provide relief, so stay tuned. Then we're going to replay the first two segments of a series, Open Arms, Open Hearts, Connecticut's Role in the Afghan Refugee Crisis. The first highlights IRIS, Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. Learn how that agency is coordinating with grassroots groups across Western Connecticut to help get Afghan refugees resettled and how you can help. Then we're going to reach out to the CEO of the Connecticut Institute for Refugees and Immigrants, Siri, about an important new partnership with the Bridgeport Rescue Mission. And we're going to wrap things up circling back to an October chat with the leader of the Domestic Violence Crisis Center to learn how that agency's been doing coming through the pandemic and how it's doubling down to help educate communities to prevent domestic violence and better support those who are impacted by it. We'll be right back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People New Year's Encore with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Connecticut's Read to Grow nonprofit is working to promote language skills and literacy for children beginning at birth and to support parents as their baby's first teachers. The organization has launched its Popcorn and PJs Read with the Author series for 2022, kicking off January 28th at 7 p.m. with Coy Bowles and Behind the Little Red Door. Other authors in the series include Janet Costa Bates and Alexandra Alessandri and illustrator Courtney Dawson. Find out how to sign up or receive services from this unique childhood literacy nonprofit by visiting readtogrow.org. Well, as we mentioned in the introduction, or as you may have heard in the PSAs we've been running for the past few weeks, we have been talking about this these two studies going on at the Yale Child Study Center. And I'm so pleased now to be able to fill in a lot of the blanks or answer a lot of the questions that you may have if you know or are the parent or caregiver of a child or teen who's suffering from anxiety. Dr. Ellie Leibowitz is here. He's associate professor in the Yale Child Study Center and the point person for these two studies that are happening. The Anxiety and Mood Disorders Program at the Yale Child Study Center offers comprehensive evaluations and treatments for children and adolescents ages 6 to 14 years. Many of the services are provided at no cost to families who agree to participate in research or can otherwise be provided for a fee. We are hoping that one of these two clinical studies may be able to provide answers for you and a young person that you know that might be suffering from crippling anxiety. And Dr. Leibowitz, thank you so much for joining us. We talked a little bit about before we went on the air about this crush of demand for young people who are going into Connecticut's hospital and healthcare systems undergoing mental health and anxiety crises. So these studies seem to be the right thing at the right time.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, first of all. And yeah, absolutely. You know, even in the best of times, anxiety problems really are among the most prevalent or the most prevalent and common mental health problems for children and for adults as well. But the truth of the matter is, these have not been the best of times. And we have all been living through 2 years that seem almost engineered to make anxiety worse. You know, the disruptions to people's schedules, the uncertainty that so many children have been experiencing. And so we are seeing so much need, and we really are working very hard both to serve the children and the families that are coping with anxiety, and also to learn more about the causes and the best treatments for anxiety.
Great. I just want to remind listeners, we are chatting with Dr. Leibowitz by cell, so there might be a little bit of a signal interruption or distortion. We apologize for that. So Dr. Leibowitz, what I found interesting is that your program treats a wide range of anxiety disorders and fears. But as I was reading down the list, I mean, you know, excessive worrying and social anxiety seem pretty academic, but also, for young people who are having difficulties or refusal to speak to other children or adults outside their immediate family, this kind of like sudden switching on of nonverbal, you know, situation, separation anxiety, or of course anxiety related to school, test taking, speaking class, even attending, or well as specific fears like fear of heights or dogs or loud noises. These are all things that are contributing to a lot of anxiety in young people. And as we had talked about, then you add the entire brand new world of trying to live in this kind of COVID-19 society. And it is creating an epidemic of mental health crisis, especially in these young people. So you've got two studies going on. Let's hear about the first one, which is for children 6 to 12 years.
Yeah, that's actually exactly right. This is a study for children ages 6 to 12 who are coping with some of the problems that you were describing: separation anxiety, social anxiety, excessive worry, etc. And through this study, children and families can really get comprehensive assessment and evaluation of the anxiety problem, but also get really efficacious and effective evidence-based treatments. And maybe one thing that's interesting about this study in particular is that we're actually comparing two different kinds of treatments, both of which are well supported by evidence. But one of those treatments is working directly with a child, a treatment called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, where a child meets directly with a therapist to learn skills and tools that they can use. The other treatment is actually entirely parent-based. And so families who receive that treatment, what will happen is that the parents will actually be meeting with a therapist on a regular basis, and they'll be learning the tools and the skills that they can use to help their child overcome anxiety. And so regardless of which treatment the family or that particular child ends up receiving, there's a really good chance that that would be very helpful to them in overcoming the anxiety problem.
So I noticed this supportive parenting for anxious childhood emotions or space initiative has its own website, spacetreatment.net. Is that something that is overseen by you or folks in your department?
Yes, exactly. That is a website that's overseen by me. So SPACE is a treatment that we developed here at the Child Study Center and have been testing and is now being widely disseminated around the country and around the world. And there is so much enthusiasm for this treatment because parents really feel empowered, and it's so gratifying to be able to help your child overcome a problem. One thing that so many parents are going to be struggling with is that when you have a child with a lot of anxiety, you'll often find yourself as the parent getting drawn in to a lot of what we call accommodations of the child's anxiety. So for example, if your child has social anxiety or struggles to speak, like you described earlier, you may find yourself having to do that for them. Or if they have separation anxiety, you may find yourself not being able to go out, or maybe having to sleep next to them at night. Or maybe they just have a lot of worry, like in generalized anxiety, and you're spending so much time trying to reassure them, answer all their worried questions. And SPACE, supportive parenting for anxious childhood emotions, gives the parents the tools to reduce that accommodation, which ends up actually being unhelpful, although it's really well-intentioned on parents' part, but to replace it with what we call supportive parental responses that really build the child's confidence in their own ability to handle anxiety. And so that treatment, SPACE, is one of the two treatments that families can receive through this study. And the other is cognitive behavioral therapy that is a really well-established and evidence-based frontline treatment. Parents who want to learn more about SPACE can visit that website, spacetreatment.net. net, but that's one of the treatments that they could receive through this study. So one other thing that's interesting about this particular study is that we're also using this as an opportunity to learn more about the brain and what changes, for example, in a child's brain function as they go through these treatments and as their anxiety is improving. So families who participate in this will also be able to teach us so much more about the human brain and how it functions in the context of anxiety.
And those that are accepted will either receive the CBT or the SPACE program, and there will be some nominal compensation as well. Those who qualify with their children 6 to 12 years will either get CBT or SPACE as well as some nominal compensation.
Correct. Yes, there is compensation because we really want to learn as much as we can and to be helpful to as many families as we can. But yes, they will receive either SPACE or cognitive behavioral therapy. I want to make sure to mention the phone number so that people actually know where to find us if they do want to get this kind of help. So let me just say that the phone number for our program is 203-737-4644. And families, parents can call that number, and we will talk with them, we'll discuss with them whether this seems like a good fit for their child, and we'll be happy to have them come in so that we can really get the ball rolling to help them get feeling better as soon as possible.
Okay, I understand folks can also email anxiety.csc@yale.edu. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. anxiety.csc@yale.edu.
Great. And folks listening, we will absolutely give you these again before we wrap up with Dr. Leibowitz. So now let's shift gears because there's a second trial for children 10 to 14.
Correct. And this trial is just, I think, really exciting and fascinating as well, because here, this is a study for children who are struggling with social anxiety. That may mean that they have difficulty talking with other people, answering a question in class, joining a group, being in a performance, all these things that make up so much of the kind of rich experience of growing up, and yet so many children really struggle with those things. And what is also, I think, really interesting about this study is that we're testing a treatment that is really entirely computer-based. And so instead of coming in and kind of talking with a therapist and discussing the problem, children are coming in, they're essentially playing a game on a computer, and they're practicing a task that is training their brain to be less focused on the kind of negative things in our lives, on the more anxiety-inducing things in our environment, and really training their brain to kind of look away from those things and focus a little bit more on the positive. Because one thing that we know about anxiety is that people who struggle with anxiety, including kids, will often have what we call a bias in their attention. And so instead of, kind of attending equally to different things, their attention is drawn really powerfully to the kinds of things that actually end up maintaining their anxiety. But it means for children that they can come in, and it's a relatively brief treatment. They come in, it's just 4 weeks, and they will be practicing doing this task on the computer. And so many kids will be, I think, really liking that kind of a treatment because it's really different than what we often think about in terms of therapy.
So that would be a twice-a-week session for 4 weeks, also with some nominal compensation.
Yes, that's correct.
And for the prior study for the younger children, 6 to 12, that is a 12-week session once per week?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Fantastic. Great. Well, in the last few minutes that we have with you, Dr. Leibowitz, for folks that may not be necessarily ready or able to apply for one of these two clinical trials, could you offer them any basic information on how to best recognize and initiate the conversation with a child or a teenager in order to hopefully at least start getting some buy-in and some common understanding that there is an issue that might require some sort of treatment?
Absolutely. I think that's a really important question because we don't always do a good enough job of having those conversations and being able to communicate openly about things that we're coping with. So let me make a few simple suggestions. One of them is start with yourself. You can teach your child that it is okay to talk about the struggles in life, to talk about the harder things by modeling that. So when you're having dinner or you're sitting around and chatting, don't talk only about, you know, all the positives, which are really important, but it's okay to sometimes say, you know, today I was struggling with something. Today I had a worried thought. Today I felt a little bit down. And you're making that part of the way that we communicate. Mm. The second thing is to have a really open and non-judgmental kind of conversation with your child. You know, if you give them the sense that talking about a problem or expressing a difficulty is something that would be maybe criticized or just really kind of charged emotionally, then it might be harder for them to do it. Let them lead you. You can just ask questions and don't demand that they tell you everything. And if sometimes your child, you know, you ask them, how was your day? And they say, oh, nothing happened. Mm. Then that's okay. And lots of kids are going to respond that way. But you show them that you are interested, that you're there, that you want to be supportive. Ask them if they'd perhaps rather speak to somebody else. Sometimes, even though we'd love our kids to tell us everything, sometimes they might be a little bit more comfortable talking to another person. Let them know that that is okay also. And I also want to mention a book that I think could be a useful resource for a lot of parents, which is called Breaking Free of Child Anxiety and OCD. And that's a book that's written by me directly for parents with a lot of tools for how you can talk to your child about the anxiety and how you can help them overcome anxiety, even without actual therapy.
Fantastic. Dr. Ellie Leibowitz is an associate professor at the Yale Child Study Center. If you joined us late or want to learn more about their SPACE program, of course, you can go to spacetreatment.net. If you're interested in finding out more or applying for one of the two clinical studies that we talked about, you can call 203-737-4644. That's 203-737-4644 and tell them you heard about it on this radio station on For the People. Or you can go to anxiety.csc@yale.edu. That CSC is, of course, for the Child Study Center. anxiety.csc@yale.edu. Dr. Leibowitz, great to talk to you, and we're so pleased to learn more about the great work that you're doing down at the Anxiety and Mood Disorders Program at the Child Study Center. Thanks so much for being on our program today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, we chatted with him back in April as we were kind of beginning to look at the next new potential wave of refugees that would be coming into the United States and to Connecticut. But since then, a lot has happened, including the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan, which produced the humanitarian crisis of our time. Since then, we have had the pleasure of already welcoming several hundred Afghan refugees, many of whom have members who were supporting U.S. operations. They were fixers, they were translators, go-betweens, many of them responsible for sustaining and protecting and saving the lives of our U.S. service people and United States government officials and others who are working in Afghanistan. So when we heard the latest call from Governor Lamont to not only make these individuals welcome here in Connecticut, but a plea to landlords to open up their homes and perhaps riffing off of that for others who might have a place for these refugees to open up those places to them. So we decided to get back with Chris George. He's executive executive director of IRIS, which is Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. They are one of two major organizations in the state of Connecticut that are working with these Afghan refugees coming in. Refugee families who arrive from overseas come to the United States often with virtually no material possessions. They've lost their home, their friends, their family, their country, their culture, and their jobs. Most don't speak English, and they have no income, and many are victims of trauma with physical or mental health needs. And IRIS provides targeted wraparound services for all these clients using a strength-based assessment model that offers long-term support for successful integration. So beyond the boilerplate, Chris, tell us a little bit about where we are as we're taping this here on the 12th of November. We're expecting like 800 to 1,000 in Connecticut or more. How many are here with us in our neighborhoods already?
Well, you're right, John. The Taliban takeover of Afghanistan changed everything. And as you said, any Afghan who had any connection at all, whether they were an interpreter for special forces at one end of the spectrum, or they ran the laundry service at the Marine base in Kandahar, no matter what their connection with the U.S. government, they felt they were in danger. They were in danger of being targeted by the Taliban, they and their family members. So as many as could fled to the airport, managed to make it through that crazy, chaotic gauntlet, and got on planes. And the U.S. government is trying to resettle about 100,000 Afghans across the United States. Connecticut has so far welcomed about 250 in just roughly 2 months. 250 would be a relatively large number of refugee arrivals for a year. Mm-hmm. And we have done that number in just 2 months. Normally we have 2 or 3 weeks notice before a family comes. Now we're lucky if we have 2 or 3 days notice. In the past, usually one family at a time would arrive. Now, in some cases, we've been welcoming 4 or 5 families on one day. So it's a pretty crazy time for refugee resettlement agency, not just IRIS in Connecticut, but all of the 200 or so refugee agencies across the country are being asked to do some pretty heroic work.
Yeah, depending on the size of their jurisdiction, the incoming onslaught of refugees is proportional. So we're talking about some agencies that are handling, probably approaching, 8 or 10,000.
Some single agencies are going to approach about 2,000.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
You're right. It has been really difficult. It's not the total number. I mean, resettling 100,000 refugees in 1 year can be done. That's not outrageous. But to resettle them over a 4-month period is really difficult. Mm. And you mentioned one of the major bottlenecks, which is housing.
Yeah. We've only got about 3 or 4 more minutes with you, Chris. So essentially this call, which is going to be the first of a number that we're going to have with you and other agencies in Connecticut over the next few months, is really kind of going to be kicking off a series on opening our homes and hearts to our refugees, particularly those who are of service in some way, shape, or form to protecting and sustaining our American forces and others in country. Mm-hmm. So what are the most important things that you could ask for right now of people here in Connecticut?
Right now, the big ask is form a group. If you can do it, if you live in a community where there are a number of people who would like to roll up their sleeves and welcome a Afghan refugee family to their community, then form a group, contact IRIS. We will train you, and we will place a refugee family in your community a month later. And it is the most rewarding, satisfying, and challenging community project you will ever do. Mm. And already more than 30 groups across the state of Connecticut have stepped forward.
So if people want to know more, they can go to IRISCT.org to get connected and learn more about how IRIS is doing their work. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's right. We call this community-based resettlement or community co-sponsorship. Most refugee agencies across the country will resettle refugees with their staff, sometimes with a few volunteers helping here and there. But we've got this model in Connecticut that's been very successful, and it's now being replicated across the country, where we take a community group, train them, and they do everything. I mean, everything my staff does, the community group does. They'll find the apartment, they'll furnish the apartment, they'll welcome the family, they'll meet them at the airport, they'll get the kids enrolled in school, the members of the family connected to health care, they'll help the parents learn English, and they'll help the parents get jobs. And they can do this. I mean, members of these groups are experienced people. They've got great life skills, which includes enrolling kids in school, connecting people to health care, helping them get jobs. So it is something that is definitely doable for handful of people from a community in Connecticut.
And it's almost inconceivable for people here in Connecticut and in the United States to think that something went horribly wrong in their country and suddenly they and their families' lives were in danger and they had to suddenly rip themselves out of their home and their lifestyle and go to a completely different foreign country, possibly for the rest of their lives. It's important for people to empathize and try to put themselves in the shoes and the places of these refugees in order to try to relate and find the inspiration to step up, find or form one of these groups and make it happen. And it's great to know that IRIS is there to help. And I'm glad that you're such an important and willing resource for our program, Chris. So we're looking forward to talking with you again in a few weeks to learn more about specifics, maybe to meet a few of these groups, just to help continue to familiarize people with how easy it is, but how important it is for them to step up right now on behalf of these, 800 to 1,000. Six or seven more hundred refugees who are going to be coming in the coming months. So thank you so much for your time at this point. And once again, folks, if you want to learn more, go to IRISCT.org. And Chris, George, for now, we thank you so much for your work and your group's work, and we will be back in touch soon. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Paid leave benefits through the Connecticut Paid Leave Program became available January 1st for workers who have completed the application process. As this program is new to both businesses and workers in Connecticut, it's important for employers to understand the application process and their responsibilities in the rollout of the Connecticut Paid Leave Program. Workers are likely to have questions, and employers, small and large, need to be equipped to help answer those questions. But don't worry, Connecticut Paid Leave is there to help by offering resources, support, and educational tools designed to help employers, administrators, and workers navigate the Connecticut Paid Leave Program. Qualified workers can complete an application by calling 877-499-8255. 8606. Or if you are an employer or worker with questions, you can start by visiting ctpaidleave.org. Well, since we closed last week's show with our friend Chris George at IRIS, it's only appropriate that we open this week with our friends at the Connecticut Institute for Refugees and Immigrants, SIRI. And I'm so pleased to be able to do that as we take on our next segment in this series. We're calling Open Arms, Open Hearts, Connecticut's Role in the Afghan Refugee Crisis. And you, each and every one of you with ears on the podcast or on the radio, have a role to play here in Connecticut. We've got 800 to 1,000 Afghan refugees coming into the state as we speak. Several hundred here already, many more to come. Winter's coming, and we need to provide a warm home and welcome these folks and families who have been through so much. So, so pleased to be here with Susan Schnitzer of SIRI. And Susan, how is it going these days? Are you back up to your kind of 7-day, 10-hour-a-day routine?
We are, John. Thank you for having us. We're really thrilled to be here. Yes, we are back up fully running. We actually never closed during COVID, so we've been running at full capacity nonstop. And I do have to say, you know, to utilize your words, the state really has been welcoming with open arms and open hearts for decades for immigrants and refugees coming to Connecticut and making new homes here. And so it's no surprise to us, but incredibly heartwarming that folks, there's a huge outpouring of support for our new neighbors that have fled Afghanistan, coming to resettle in the country.
Well, your organization provides top-notch legal, social, and educational programming for refugees, immigrants, and also for survivors of human trafficking and torture. And that's not really something we touched upon in our interview last week, but it really is kind of important to educate people and to talk a little bit more about how victims of human trafficking and torture, how that so incredibly compounds the challenges of relocation for some of the refugees. Are you seeing any of our Afghan new neighbors who are coming in who have been victimized in that way?
So we don't... not currently, but typically what we will do with specifically human trafficking is if we do assess for risk factors. Mm. What's different with the refugee resettlement and the resettlement of the Afghan folks coming is in more traditional times, if there is such a thing, we usually get about 2 to 3 weeks notice when a family will be arriving. Mm-hmm. And with that notice, we know the names of everyone in the family members. We get a lot of background information. And most of the folks are coming from refugee camps, mm-hmm. Where they've spent, you know, 10 to 20 years, a lot of them. A lot of the children we resettle who are under the age of 10 were born in these camps. So while that is a horrendously long time to wait after having fled a horrendous situation, there's time to kind of sit and settle and plan next steps. Mm. The folks coming from Afghanistan have quite literally fled their homes with a bag, if they have the bag, jumped on a plane, and a lot of them did not know where they would be landing. So, you know, they're coming here, they're hosted at our military bases. But the time from, you know, leaving your living room to landing in a new living room here in Connecticut could be as quick as a month. So we are really mindful of the fact that folks need a chance to really sit with themselves, with their families, with other community members, and get their bearings. And, you know, our job upon arrival is to make sure folks are comfortable, whether it is in an apartment that we have beautifully furnished by a host of faith-based groups that assist us, or at something very new and unique, I think, across the country, definitely here in the state and definitely for SIRI, is a partnership that we have with Bridgeport Rescue Mission. Mm-hmm. who, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, the good friends of ours here at For the People. We just did a segment on them within the past couple of months, they've been on the program so many times, and I have had personal opportunity to work with that group over the past 25 years, and you have acquired a fantastic partner there. Let's talk a little bit about Bridgeport Rescue Mission and this new collaboration with the Afghan refugees.
Yes, for sure. So both Bridgeport Rescue Mission and CRE have been in the Bridgeport area for over 100 years, and this is our strongest collaboration. At least I have not been here for 100 years, but that I know of. Mm-hmm. So how this came about is Kim Fawcett, who's one of their directors over there, saw an article about CRE and resettling the Afghan evacuees, and they had space. They have a gorgeous building, brand new building, and a floor that is going to be dedicated as a women and children's program. They were not ready to open that program yet. Saw the need and reached out to us. And kind of long story short, we had a number of meetings. I know you've had Kim on your show, so you know how fabulous she is,
yeah,
and her team. And our teams are they're working together like they always have, right? Like they didn't just meet each other, that we've been doing this for decades. So what Bridgeport Rescue Mission has offered to our new neighbors is a space that is safe, that is beautiful, that is incredibly culturally appropriate for the folks coming, where they can spend some time, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, before we find that permanent housing. And we are able to put five families in family suites. They are able to separate the shower facilities, which is very important for the folks coming in, between the men and the women. They have a beautiful community area where the clients are now cooking together, sharing meals together, and the clients themselves welcoming new clients as they come into the facility at Bridgeport Rescue Mission.
Well, I think it's also important, Susan, to kind of delineate in my assessment. There's two major representations in the groups of Afghan refugees that are coming in. There are the folks who fear or do not want any part of Taliban rule. And then there are those who are actually under threat, in many cases, of death by the Taliban because they supported U.S. efforts. They translated or were fixers or assistants to the U.S. military. And so what is the proportion of people that you're seeing who are either expected or are already here, who are simply fleeing the oppressive regime of the Taliban versus those who had no other choice to go or face death?
So that is a number we don't even have on a national level right now. I can tell you with the clients that we have received, the majority of them are either under direct threat or they have family members who have been involved with the United States military and the efforts you described, and it could be a cousin, it could be a fourth cousin,
sure,
who are under direct threat. I would say that's a majority of folks that we're seeing. And I would argue that those who are not related to somebody who has worked, worked in collaboration with the U.S., the risk is just as great for them. What we're hearing is people are going door to door, and it's not just those who have been involved with the American military that are at immediate risk for torture, death. So anyone coming, anyone who has fled, in my belief and what we've seen, has fled for their lives.
Okay. So in the last couple minutes that we have with you, Susan, as we did with our partners here with Iris, please speak to our listeners and let them know how they could help a little, how they could help a lot. I know that a lot of people, they know coming into the wintertime, it's going to be tough. Coming into the holiday season, it's going to be tough. What can our listeners do for Siri and for your new Afghan neighbors?
Sure, wonderful. So first, I want to thank people, because as I've said before, and a lot of us have said, our folks, our neighbors in Connecticut have been incredibly, incredibly welcoming. Our largest challenge right now is finding affordable apartments. For Siri, that's specifically Bridgeport and surrounding areas, and even up in New Haven. Very similar to Iris in New Haven. A lot of folks do have family members and friends that are living in that community. So any leads, any connection for apartments. The second thing is, donate to our agency. Any amount is very helpful. And keep an eye out for where we are going to need more volunteers for, maybe something that's a little more person to person. Right now, we are trying to get folks in apartments, get those apartments set up. We have a lot of community groups doing drives. So drives, collecting glasses for 30, 30, 40, 50 families, cutlery, those types of things. And people can go to our website, www.cirict.org. And there's everything we need and we're looking for are on those websites. And the last thing I will say is just, keep building your communities, keep welcoming new people into communities, regardless of where they're from.
Very good. And of course, a shout out to all of the faith-based networks who are already working hand in hand and again, almost 24/7 with Siri and our other intake agencies here in Connecticut, because they are leading the charge. And chances are, if you're part of a faith-based community, they leadership is already engaged with Siri or other agencies over this effort. So enough can't be said for our faith-based communities and partners here, as well as our friends at Bridgeport Rescue Mission, who are jumping in to assist with the incoming and existing Afghan refugees. We really appreciate you, Susan. Susan Schnitzer is the CEO of Siri, the Connecticut Institute for Refugees and Immigrants, serving our community since 1918. So you know that they do a great job, and we really thank you for your time this morning, Susan. And we look forward to working with you as this situation continues to develop. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, John, and thank you to all your listeners as well.
Well, here we are in October, Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and we are so pleased to have Suzanne Adam on the line with the Domestic Violence Crisis Center. That organization is serving areas of Connecticut to support individuals on their journey to safety. They advocate for individuals who are experiencing abuse in personal relationships and provide multiple services with their professional staff to help those experiencing any level of domestic violence and assisting them in building a safer environment for the well-being of themselves and their families. All their services are free and confidential and offered in a multicultural, multilingual environment. DVCCCT.org is their website. And Suzanne, welcome to the program, Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So you guys are busy, busy, busy.
We certainly are. Thank you so much, John, for having me today. It's a very exciting time. We are shining a light on a very important cause. Most importantly, letting people know that help is available right here in their backyard.
And as we've heard from organizations like yours for the past almost 2 years, the COVID-19 pandemic has made things so much worse. Give us an idea of the comparative statistics over the past 12 to 18 months versus the kind of caseload and constituent services you were providing before we ever heard of this COVID-19.
Oh, certainly. Last year, we did help 3,481 victims right here in our community. Regarding COVID, the average stay in our safe housing increased 3 times. Our counseling and support services per client in our community increased by 25%. And the number of advocacy services provided to people in our community increased by 147%. And that really tells us that not only is domestic violence a pervasive issue in our community, but the pandemic compounded the challenge that people had by, you know, staying home to stay safe. Domestic violence is about isolation. And because people were further isolated by the pandemic, it exacerbated an already untenable situation. So instead of coming to our offices or calling our hotline once a week, once a month, once in a blue moon when they needed help, people went up 147%. And that speaks volumes to us doing this very important work.
So what is really going to help kind of stem this co-epidemic situation is getting a better understanding about the issue and changing the conversation about victims. A lot of people still think of domestic violence as cohabitating couple or intimate partners or family members, siblings, parents, and children. They get into a fight and then it comes to blows, and then the domestic violence incident is defined. But it's so much more than that.
Absolutely. You know, domestic violence is so prevalent and it's incredibly misunderstood. Anyone, race, gender, sexual identity, orientation, your socioeconomic status, anyone can become a victim of domestic violence. Domestic violence is rooted in power and control. It truly is a pattern of behavior. It's not someone just having a bad day or struggling with how to control their emotions. And it may not always manifest physically. And I think that's another complicated factor that people think they need to be black and blue and experience bruises. Abuse can also be verbal, financial, sexual, or technology related. It may not start out as physical violence, taking someone's cell phone, withholding money, gaslighting, letting people think that they made a mistake when they really didn't, withholding children or important documents. These are all different forms of abuse. Also, we know that abuse escalates and tends to escalate over time. It may begin with verbal abuse, but over time, it can turn to physical violence. We also know, John, that leaving is the most dangerous time for a victim. Sadly, just this past year, we had a tragic murder-suicide. Divya Misra, a beloved employee of the Norwalk Library, was killed by her husband on the day she served him with divorce papers. Luckily, we now have legislation in Connecticut known as Jennifer's Law locally that expands the definition of domestic violence to include coercive control. This way, victims don't have to wait until physical violence occurs to get that legal protective orders against their abusers. We also need a greater understanding about the way domestic violence impacts victims. It can affect every area of their life, from personal safety to mental health to financial stability. Answering your question additionally, like, why don't they just leave? We know as advocates that it's complicated. The reasons people stay is financial dependence, fear of retaliation. Simply, they just love the person. They don't want the relationship to end. They simply want the abuse to stop. And we know that it takes up to seven times, research shows, for a victim to leave their abuser before they're finally able to be out of the relationship for good. Regardless of what stage or what they're experiencing, we are here. The Domestic Violence Crisis Center is here to meet and support victims wherever they are on their journey. And our wraparound services help people address all different issues a victim might be facing.
Well, one would think with all the information and all the advocacy and all of the TV and cable and media programs, both dramatized, documentary, news reports, educational advocacy, you'd think that the victim blame tendency would be completely worked out of the equation. But in fact, this still is a main driver for why people still tend to either look away or just sadly say, you know, this is really kind of just part of our culture and our society, and we're never going to be rid of it.
Right. I think how we can change that conversation and the victim blaming is, number one, believe victims. You and I may know the same couple, but the husband's experience of the wife, or the wife's experience of the husband, or the teen's experience of their boyfriend, they are personal. What we see on the soccer field or in the store or at the dinner party or even at work is different than what victims experience at home. It's about control, and I'm controlling one individual, and that typically is private and happens at home. So the first thing we can do is believe victims. When people show you who they are, you need to believe them. And unfortunately, victims very often are not supported because we can't imagine that someone we know or someone who professes to love them could be doing this much harm. So believing victims is the first important tenet that we can share. And the other is learn to recognize the red flags. They may not always look like bruises or a broken bone. You know, be willing to check in with your friends. Are they becoming increasingly isolated? Do they look a little, you know, physically, do they look a little more skittish? Are they not always making eye contact? Are they always making an excuse about why they're late for an appointment or not being able to get to work on time? Check in with your friends, your neighbors, your colleagues, even the stranger you see at Walmart or Target who might be struggling, and ask if you're okay. And then the most important thing is, if they answer no, don't panic. You don't need to know what to do. You just need to know help is available. Connect your friends, family to help and support with a trained domestic violence advocate so we can increase their chances of survival.
You know, what's so ironic, Suzanne, is that, you know, for the past, you know, decade, maybe even decade and a half, our society has been working so hard through public education systems, summer camps, municipal programs, teaching kids about bullying and stepping in and stepping up against bullies. And I hope I'm not minimizing it by saying that domestic violence is really kind of the ultimate form of bullying. And so I really, really appreciate you talking about possibly even taking the initiative to step in to initiate with a total stranger who you may see in a parking lot, at a bar, at a party, who you maybe witness an interaction with another person who makes you feel uncomfortable. So when that person may be stepping away, there really is something to be said for stepping up and walking over and initiating with the other person that may be the abused one and trying to offer some assistance.
Right. I totally agree. The ultimate form of bullying, I think, is a great way of explaining. A bully very often does things publicly, and that may happen with these relationships. But at the end of the day, they're using their power to bully a person into complacency, into what they want. And I think people understanding, we can confront a bully, whether we do on the street, whether we do at the school, whether we do at the workplace. And what happens when someone on the playground sees someone else stick up for them or call that bully out? The person stands a little straighter. they feel supported.
Yep.
And maybe next time they'll be brave enough to say no themselves.
Yep.
And then victims of domestic violence, maybe next time they'll know that help is available and you are a trusted person
yep.
that they can speak to when life gets challenging or scary again.
Well, we've got a minute or two left. Folks who may want to support the Domestic Violence Crisis Center have an opportunity to do so in pretty short order by taking a quick moon dance with your organization. Let's hear about that event.
Right, yeah. We want people to know that DVCC is here to support victims and educate our community. If you need help, you can call or text our statewide hotline at 888-774-2900. Also, as John stated, we are so excited about our upcoming fundraiser. It's called the Harvest Fest, a wonderful night for a moon dance. If you're looking for a way to support victims or just to have fun, we're having a great event Friday, October 27th. 22nd, my apologies, Friday, October 22nd at 6:30 at the Shorehaven Golf Club in Norwalk. We're going to have dinner and dancing. We also will have the band Fake ID. It's going to be a really fun evening, and you certainly can purchase your tickets by making a donation at dvccp.org.
So that's coming up this weekend as we play this on Sunday morning the 17th, or folks are listening to the podcast during the week. So it's important to go to dvccp.org, their website, if you want to be part of the marvelous night for a moon dance fundraising activity. Suzanne Adam is the executive director during October here, Domestic Violence Awareness Month. The Domestic Violence Crisis Center stands ready to support, educate, and assist victims in a multicultural, multilingual environment to help ensure that all of their free and confidential services are rendered toward the effort of helping and supporting them and lifting them above their domestic violence crisis. Suzanne, great to meet you, and thank you so much for being part of the program today. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.